You're listening to Architecture Masters.
This was our third nomination. And I think actually for me, I've really felt that it deserved to win. You know, it was absolutely, I was just over the moon. You know, as a practice, as an architecture practice, what do you want to do? Build iconic buildings. So, you know, and I say this, I hope, in the spirit that it needs to be taken. And that is, I think it was a generosity of spirit that led us to step back and say, no, it's creating great places and spaces is what we do, and we do it for people. It's absolutely right that we hold ourselves back and we don't do actually what was wanted. We actually talked the peer out of designing an iconic building. No, I had no plan. I mean, I'm sorry, I wish I could say that I had some kind of long-term vision for my life, but absolutely not. I think what I've always had is a belief that I'll be okay, and that whatever, as long as I enjoy what I do and I'm passionate about what I do, that's enough of a success for me.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse. On the programme this week is Sadie Morgan. In 1995, Alex de Ryker, Philip Marsh and Sadie Morgan founded the architecture practice DRMM. The practice has had an extraordinary few years, having been shortlisted 3 times for the prestigious ROBA Stirling Prize. I joined Sadie a few days after their third nomination, Hastings Pier, had just been named the winner of this year's prize. Sadie studied interior architecture at Kingston Polytechnic and then at the Royal College of Art. The practice's first built project was at 1 Central Street in London, a solid space, the developer led by architect Roger Zagolovich. In addition to her role as founding director of the practice, Sadie has taken on a wide range of other roles, including Professor of Professional Practice at the University of Westminster, Design Panel Chair for High Speed 2, Commissioner on the National Infrastructure Commission, and one of the Mayor of London's Design Advocates, among many other roles. In this week's episode, we talk about climbing mountains and cycling across countries, about starting practices, sailing boats, and surviving cancer. I joined Sadie at the practice's offices near City Hall in London, where I started by asking her how she introduces herself.
You've got so many titles, I don't know how you introduce yourself these days.
Do you want me to go run through them all?
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, okay.
What's the headline? So, I mean,
my headline, of course, is that I'm the founding director of DRMM, but in addition to that, I chair the Independent Design Panel for High Speed 2. I sit on the National Infrastructure Commission. I am currently the deputy chair of the Thames Estuary 2050 Growth Commission.
Okay.
And a professor at Westminster.
Wow.
Oh, and okay. I'm one of the mayor's 50 design advocates. Okay. Yes. Okay.
You don't now say that you're founding director of Stirling Prize winning.
Oh, no, gosh, no, I have to get better at that. Yeah, good point. Yeah, okay, better introduce myself again. Yeah.
Last time I was in here, this building, you've been here a couple of years.
Yes,
it used to be the Architecture Foundation.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Where were you before? Where was the practice?
We've always been based in and around either London Bridge or Waterloo. So we were in Weston Street before, and before that in Central Street, which was our first ever building. Yeah.
And Roger Zagolovich has got some connections.
He's got a connection all through it. Yeah. So he was our client for Central Street. And then when we left Central Street, ultimately became our landlord in our first studio and then again this one.
Okay. And how many people in the practice now?
There are about 50 of us now, but that's the largest we've ever been, and I think probably about where we see, you know, maximum.
So you're here half your time? You're here more than with all your other...
I'm probably roles, actually in the practice about 2.5 to 3 days a week.
Okay.
And I think I manage my time in a way that is much more focused and condensed. So, right. At least I tell the practice that my 3 days are worth, you know, 5 days or 3 days. No, I mean, I think that you, as you get older and your experience, you know, you tend to have a little bit more experience, and you're able, I think, to make decisions a bit quicker, and to evaluate things and to prioritize better.
I mean, I'm interested in how you manage your time, really. I mean, all of the roles that you've got.
Yes, I try very hard to. I think each one is specific, of course, and I when I'm part of those conversations, they're very, you know, I'm specific to that. If I'm sitting in a National Infrastructure Commission meeting, then, you know, I'll be talking about the issues around the table. And in the same way, if I'm chairing a design panel for High Speed 2, I'm focused on the work there. But everything I do has a thread that runs through it. And be it, you know, my work at DRMM or, you know, any one of these hats that I put on. So actually, my message is pretty consistent. And if I talk, you know, a lot of my time is actually spent now giving talks and lectures and trying to convince a community outside of architects the importance of creative thinking.
And on top of all of that, training for, we're talking to Mary Duggan, say a month ago, about cycling and about, have you been or are you just going to Kilimanjaro?
Oh, no, I've been, right. Yeah. I mean, I've always loved, you know, sport.
Yeah.
And that's manifest itself in generally things around water, actually. So swimming, rowing, sailing. And I sailed competitively for a couple of years, and then
these are kind of lifetime crowning achievements for some people.
I was part of a team that won the GB Commodores for the GB team that won the Commodores Cup and won our class in the Fastnet race. So pretty amazing, extraordinary 2 years. Mm-hmm. Sailing with incredible professionals, and so that was a superb experience.
People struggle to find time to train for marathons. I mean, finding time to train for cycling to Cannes or for sailing.
I obviously have a family, and my two girls are now grown and have actually flown the nest. Both being 18 and 20, well, one's 18, one's 20, so they're off at university. Yeah. So, of course, that frees up a lot of my time. But throughout my life, we've always had a family that's quite independent and understanding of the importance of, you know, doing fulfilling things. Yeah. And that's a lot of the time as a family. You know, great holidays or going, you know, having shared experiences. But we're also very aware that that might mean having experiences outside of, you know, outside of the family unit.
So you might kind of come on to family then. Your father was an architect.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Okay. What sort of architecture did it? What was his?
He was. He studied at the AA. With Michael Hopkins and Ed Jones and, you know, that sort of era. And he chose to practice outside of London, actually. So he always had a very small practice that did very much kind of local architecture.
Right.
My mother was a accessory designer and a teacher. Okay. So they had a sort of, I'd say, a low profile. Right. That's not to diminish the quality of the work or the impact of the work, but he was very happy to have a, you know, his career I always thought was actually the us as a family. He had I was brought up in a commune which my grandfather started, so it was a very different way of life, and one where the focus on a profession or a career I'm not saying it wasn't seen as important, but it wasn't
kind of defining
characteristic. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't a defining characteristic. If you chose it not to be, you were seen as... it's
valued for other...
Yeah, exactly. It's a place where you're not judged for, you know, for your choices.
Okay. And so the interest in design and the built environment and architecture, principally from him or from other influences, what kind of led you on to...
No, I don't see it as... funnily enough, I see it as an interest in people and places rather than buildings.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, I'm absolutely passionate about the built environment in a way that I'm... More so in fact than I am individual buildings, for instance. And I'm a great advocate of spaces, but they tend to be the ones that I'm immediately in contact with. So I, I look at Alex and Philip, who have a very different interest in terms of the three-dimensional form and materiality and all of those things. And of course, I'm driven by that and I'm excited by it, but it doesn't define the way I think about architecture.
And a lot of interesting practices are formed by maybe a chance encounter or a chance meeting of a number of directors who meet and come together and have often complementary skills in different areas. You met Alex then in at Kingston, he's studying in...
Yeah, I was... both Philip and I were studying at Kingston. Alex was a tutor there and also went on to teach me when I was at the RCA. And he and Philip did a couple of projects together. When Alex was invited to submit work for the Architecture Foundation's 10 up-and-coming... they had an exhibition, 10 up-and-coming practices... he invited Philip and myself, because we'd all done little projects together, to submit. And we were chosen as one of the 10, alongside, I think, Cruz A. St. John, AHMM, Birds, Portsmouth, Russum. I mean, there are a whole load of names
Big
that
names.
Most people would be familiar with now. And the culmination of that exhibition was a competition, and we won it.
Okay.
And the competition was to build a building, and we suddenly thought, oh my God, bloody hell, we better form a practice. And that was the sort of beginning.
Of course,
the competition was never built, and then we found ourselves, with no
together
job.
And having to find...
In a practice, and we taught for a while at the AA, and which was fantastic, and... They were incredibly supportive of our need to often do projects during the holidays, in our studio space, and and then we were commissioned by Roger. I mean, we did a number of interior projects, which has kind of kept us going, and then our first major commission was with Roger for Centaur Street.
Okay. Yeah, the kind of big break.
Big break. It won 7 awards that, London Building of the Year. Yeah. It was really a kind of coming of age, and at the same time tied in with the competition win of Kingsdale School.
Right.
So we had an extraordinary few years.
And are still having an extraordinary...
We are still having extraordinary years, yes.
We'll come on to Stirling a little bit, or both Stirling
third
events.
Time lucky, that was,
Third time, so you've been shortlisted...
Twice before. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll come on to that in a minute. Jumping back then, your first degree was interior architecture, was it?
Yeah, interior architecture. I'm not a qualified architect. Everyone always assumes that I am.
Thomas Heatherwick, I suppose, is
exactly the same. So I studied interiors, then I went to the RCA and did a combined architecture interiors course.
Right.
But never have gone to, gone on to get my part three or anything. So.
And what was the I'm always interested in how people are looking for, yes, people are listening at university and thinking what they're going to do with their lives and looking at people in the profession. What direction were you thinking about when you decided to study interior architecture? Were you hoping to to start a practice? Were you hoping to? What was
No, I had no plan. I mean, I'm sorry. I wish I could say that I had some kind of long-term, you know, vision for my life, but absolutely not. I think what I've always had is a belief that I'll be okay, and that whatever, as long as I enjoy what I do and I'm passionate about what I do, that's enough of a success for me. Yeah. So I've never, you know, growing up as I have, I don't need a huge amount of things, and consequently, I'm not driven by earning huge sums of money.
Okay.
So really, principally, I've always been happy to moderate my lifestyle accordingly and therefore do what I'm happy doing.
Okay. So it was an interest in interior design,
it was much to do with my choice of A-levels, which was art, biology and physics.
Wow.
And the combination of which not any career person could help me decide what to do with.
Yeah.
So this, in the end, was
art, physics and
biology.
Wow.
And biology was actually my main love, but I couldn't go on to study it because I hadn't done chemistry. So, I mean, it's a sort of classic.
I think of our education system, really.
Yeah, I think so. And as a young woman, I hate to say that I think perhaps there was the ambition in terms of what one's profession might be was limited. So, when I chose my A-levels, for instance, the outcome would have been very different had I had different advice at the time, or any advice, actually. But hey, I think that you, when you're young and you're 16, 17, 18, you don't really know what you want to do. And, I went and did a foundation and found that I loved, making stuff, and I was good at three-dimensional things, and I was good at problem solving and planning.
Yeah.
And, so that's sort of natural fit. Yeah.
Okay. And then on to the RCA, Royal College of Art.
Yeah.
Interested again in how people choose the university. I mean, the RCA is known for, I guess all universities have particular reputations and strengths. And what was their kind of choice for the RCA?
For me, I was you say, was there a plan?
Yeah.
I had a boyfriend who was at the RCA, and I spent quite a bit of time there, and I found it the most compelling, exciting, wonderful, amazing place. And I want to go here.
Yeah.
And so I was completely driven, probably from my first or, from my second, third year onwards, that I wanted to apply to the RCA. And, and so that for me, really, that was the beginning of active choices, I loved it. I had absolutely fantastic time. I really think it was an extraordinary, Thomas Heatherwick, David AJ, Michael Marriott, furniture designer, Luke Pearson, Tom Lloyd Pearson. The names of just the year
system.
That I was,
the same
year,
kind of contemporaries,
absolutely
of,
extraordinary. From artists to filmmakers to, architects and industrial, the whole gamut was just, it was a really alive place full of,
interesting people.
Yeah, and a kind of spirit of adventure and pushing the boundaries.
Right.
I think it was a very special time.
I'm interested in that kind of special time, really, and how, you're lecturing a little bit in universities now, and the whole environment is perhaps different in universities now. Or I guess whether you think the next generation coming through still have that freedom to...
They have much, the reality is they don't have as much contact time.
Right.
I probably saw a tutor during my degree every single, at least once a day, and
okay, so
maybe
two,
maybe one or two tutorials a day. You're probably lucky if you get two a week at present. And so the input, if you like, to crafting us, you know, to crafting the next generation of designers was very different to that now. But then perhaps now, when you have to rely on yourself to explore, think, motivate, you come out with other skills. You know, to you know, that one can't also diminish that, you know, how important it is to have young people who are proactive and they're not spoon-fed. So
those are benefits. There are benefits.
Exactly. I think you just have to, you know, it is what it is. And and you find ways of making the making the best of it.
And then interesting, really, coming a little bit more to the present, you're, I mean, an interesting move in scale, really, from some of the work, that kind of interiors work, up to now a lot more about infrastructure and kind of really big thinking, you know, in terms of scale. You kind of alluded earlier on to some of that interest in bigger problem solving, and that's a kind of theme of your work a little bit now, is kind of applying brain power and problem solving to issues.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I've if you, you know, yes, they're all different scales, but they all, you know, as I said before, there's a common theme that runs through them all. And that common theme is to say, you know, if you are creative, if you have the ability to think into the future, then you are able, unlike many politicians or, say, economists, to anticipate problems, and you can, not just problems but opportunities. So if you have designers and creative thinkers brought in early in the process, and I'm not talking, you know, I'm saying right at the conception, be it you know, even how you evaluate whether a project should go ahead, you know, before, at the moment it's based on economics. It's not based on the quality of life, or that, you know, any kind of advantage to the human person, you know, the value of, you know, living in a great place, or any of those things. None of that is part of the evaluation
until kind of quite far down the process.
No, it just doesn't. No. Right. Okay. So if you say, if we got to a place where we said to those people who evaluate, why don't you think about the whole life of this project? You know, why don't you think about the values and the opportunities it might give outside of getting from A to B much quicker, and, you know, whatever it is, however it is that they, the methods that they go through. And if we start to show them the importance of combining, say, infrastructure and housing in a way that allows for better communities, better public realm, better connectivity, therefore happier, you know, happier residents who are, you know, who love where they are and who have the ability to get to work quickly or not, or, you know, have a hospital nearby, all of those things adds to the quality of life and adds to the happiness and of our nation. And why shouldn't we think that's a good thing? You know, so I kind of, you know, for me, it's saying to the people that I now meet, let's, you know, give us a problem and allow some people who have that ability to think much more creatively, three-dimensionally, to try and help you unlock some of the issues.
You've talked a little bit in other places about some of those, some friends maybe talking to you about applying for those early roles outside the practice, some of the kind of infrastructure commission and some of the, and realising you could do them and you'd be good at them. And you have been good at doing them. And I mean, I'm interested now, you're frequently sat across from, I don't know, whether it's Lord Heseltine or Lord Adonis or the Transport Secretary or the Mayor of London. I guess the next stage is thinking, well, why am I on this side of the table and not that side of the table?
I like being this side of the table. I like being part of the conversation.
Okay.
And I think it's important to have some disruptors in Westminster or in government. And but I don't think my value would be to
be a politician.
Being a politician. Yeah. I think I always say the wrong thing, and I'm probably on record doing all the, I wouldn't last a second. And I used to, as you say, you've alluded to it, and I talk about it a lot, which is, you know, when I was first asked to do these things, I was unsure of, you know, what it was that I could offer. You know, I like being in situations where I feel that I'm useful.
Yeah.
And it became very apparent that actually very few people ask the exam question. Yeah. And if you have a lot of extremely clever people who are talking about very complex high-level issues, sometimes people in place can get lost. And sometimes we all need to be reminded that those kinds of decisions that are about big, you know, infrastructure are actually about people.
Yeah.
And they need to be consistently reminded of that. And you know, I feel that I'm the I'm your conscience.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm somebody who's able to say not only that it matters, but it has to be considered and it has to be high quality.
Yeah.
You know, we deserve as UK citizens to live in nice places, to have great public space, to be able to get to and from, you know, work or home or school, you know, easily, and not be suffocated by bad fumes, you know, all of those sorts of, you know, things. We have to, somebody has to point those out.
Yeah, I'm just interested in why, you know, maybe it's something about being on the outside and persuading people on the inside, but not...
Well, a lot of my work actually, so if you look at HS2, I run I chair the design panel. The design panel is 40 people from extraordinary disciplines, backgrounds, be it, some architects, yes, but landscape designers, engineers, artists, curators, brand designers, industrial designers, furniture designers, you know, a whole gamut of interesting but incredibly successful at their, their chosen profession. And those people together are able to offer a different perspective to what is a business that is ultimately quite single-mindedly trying to build a railway, in a very short period of time and for a very, you know, for a very tight and specific cost.
Yeah.
So we are, you know, it's quite good to be outside and say, well, have you tried that? Or how about doing this?
Yeah.
Or, you know, we can innovate, we can take risks and we can offer solutions that sometimes if your head is down and you're, you know, going running towards that finish
that
line.
Yeah, you don't have to stop and think.
And I think that's very valuable. So I personally think that's probably something that I should stick to doing.
The intersection, I guess, of architecture and politics is, you know, a lot of architects are quite political, you know, and quite, but very few. George Ferguson, I suppose, is the exception.
Yeah.
People who have made that transition to the other side. And
I'm constantly amazed that as a profession, we are not being more proactive about vision, you know, about thinking long term and actually helping, you know, government and to visualize, for want of a better word, our future built environment.
Yeah.
It seems so haphazard.
Yeah.
You know, it seems so... we need a bit more strategic design and there's nobody doing that.
So coming back then to founding, you've founded your practice, the three of you originally?
Yes, Alex DeRuyter, Philip Marsh and myself, yes. We now have Jonas Lentzer, who's joined us in as a director. But
Alex, those Philip and myself early days, it, the kind of mid-90s.
Those heady days,
There were three of you. And then picking up, you talked about One Centaur Street as being kind of long life, loose fit building. Yeah. I mean, maybe just say a few words about
Centaur Street was at the time felt like a really new typology. Mm. So it was a mix. You know, at the time you had quite cellular, houses with, divided, you either had your dining room and then your kitchen and your bedrooms, and or you had these kind of amazing open, warehouse spaces where you couldn't do anything without everyone knowing about it.
Yeah.
And so Centaur Street was I think probably one of the few buildings that sort of combined the two.
Okay.
And because of its split section, you had sort of privacy and as well as a sense of openness in the living space, and then you had the bedrooms off of that. And it's a really simple but clever idea, and that Roger has gone on to
through Solid Space.
Yeah. And has had some superb architects, HMM and various others to come and sort of carry on the ethos. So for us, it was such an exciting project to work on.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to work with another, an architect as client. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Can't help but
intervene
get involved,
and change.
But, but
put the pen down. Put the pen down.
Somebody who understands your sensibility, and he was a true patron, of young. He's a true patron of young practices, and that's, that's rare. It's rare to take a risk, and I'm forever grateful to him for that.
And then, I mean, to a number of clients you've worked with, but then, growing. I mean, sort of starting then with some housing projects.
Us it was housing and school. So Kingsdale was absolutely seminal, and was one of the first BSF schools. I think it's had every single prime minister visited up until the last few, but pretty much everyone launched something
there.
Even Clinton, I think, turned up once. But so it's had really incredible. Yeah. It was seen as a huge success, just covering over the courtyard. If you go around many schools now, you see the covered courtyard type.
Yeah.
First use of cross laminated timber in the UK at the time.
Okay.
We were largest variable skin roof in the world.
Right.
We were groundbreaking in terms of the materials that we were using, and the fact that instead of knocking it down and starting again, we actually took the decision to keep it and to try and make it better for a lot of reasons. But it was an extraordinary project.
And so the client there was the local education authority or directly through the Department of Education?
Our first client actually was the Architecture Foundation. So Lucy Musgrave, who was the director at the time, ran this incredible sort of competition to find designers who would help to show through their design that good space, lifted results.
Yeah.
So there's a direct correlation between your environment and your academic success.
Okay.
So Kingsdale was what they called, a sink school.
Yeah.
It was on special measures. It was in big trouble.
Right.
And I think through a combination of things, once we finished as a team, from educators to architects to the headmaster, it was the best performing school in Southwark. Best improved school in Southwark 5 years later. So, and now it's it's a beacon, and everybody wants to send their children there. You know, all the nice middle class mums and dads want to set, you know. I mean, so it's a sort of, I'm not saying suggesting that means it's a success, but I think that it's, it is the focus and the belief in the existing community, school community, and the fact that somebody was investing in it, not just architecture, not just time and, sorry, money, but kind of, you know, a real, you know, sort of spirit, you know, we believed in that, you know, it's like, oh my God, is this for us? You know, I remember, you know, everyone being amazed that there wasn't a touch of graffiti, you know, when we finished, because, you know, everybody...
There's respect for...
There was absolute respect, and everybody had been involved doing it. Everyone was so proud of it.
Yeah.
You know,
the local community.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, and it's a similar experience with Hastings Pier. It's like, if you are the curators of... a vision that others are a part of, then you end up with a result that's much, you know, bigger than the sum of its parts, and has a spirit to it that you just, you can't get in, it's really hard to achieve. And I think often one of the special things about our projects is often people say they're joyful, you know, or they're, you know, there's a sense of fun, or there's, I don't know if it's that, because we're very, you know, we're quite serious, you know, it's not, we're serious architects, but I think what it is actually a spirit, you know, that our buildings have soul, and that's because they belong to the people who use them, or the community, exactly, and that, so they're sort of full of love. And not, you know, that's, I mean, you know, there's plenty of incredible, wonderful architects who do that, exactly that, you know, we're not unique. But
it's interesting. I mean, you've talked a little bit in other places about the kind of changing role of the architect and automation and lots of parts of the work being automated and having to change as architects to do. And I guess maybe coming on then to Hastings Pier, you know, some of the community engagement and crowdfunding. And is that how architects should be moving in their work, do you think, for people coming through the profession now?
I think architects have to think about their relevance in the future, and that you can explore that in many different ways. Yeah. So I think that there's very little money around, and we have to find innovative ways of funding projects, particularly kind of restoration type projects, which ultimately was the pier. And so the, you know, Hastings Pier in that sense is an extraordinarily good example of bottom up, kind of regeneration. And if you're looking at large swathes of the country, which, you know, so I sit on the Thames Estuary Commission, Growth Commission, it's had a number of big master plans by very famous, well-known architects come and, you know, and actually I think we have to move to a place where we're not talking about master plan, we're kind of talking about an overall loose structure which helps to nurture existing and existing possibilities and sort of draws them, helps through good governance and various other things, draws them together. And then, so that's sort of one aspect of the future. And then you look at another aspect of the future, which is the extraordinary pace of new technology. And, you know, I sit on the National Infrastructure with Demis Hassabis, who's who is the artificial intelligence guru, has written software that has beaten Go, which is is a game that has more computations than stars in the sky. Now he is, you know, those kind of algorithms that are now being, you know, built are
sort of so disruptive.
Powerful.
Yeah.
They are so powerful, and the capability to do many things with those, you know, with that kind of computer learning. I think we have to, as architects, understand that, you know, all the structures that are that hold the signposts up over our motorways are designed by computers.
Yeah,
they're designed by algorithms that work out the least amount of steel that is needed. There's there's no designers anymore. Yeah. It's a computer that's doing that. Yeah. So, you know, if you translate that 10 or 15 years ahead, you know, we have to be careful that we are that our skills are those that guide, shape, curate, because, you know, they're the things that we're really good at, and we have to be better at collaboration. And I'm not talking about engineers, and, you know, I'm talking about collaborating
big scale
with future thinkers and combining that thinking to create a better long-term, you know, better sustainable built environment.
Change must be incredibly, for people coming into the profession now, the potential for change within the profession must be incredibly alarming and scary. And you've, I guess, always seemed happy with change, with, you know, taking on new roles.
No,
is that a driver for success, do you think, that kind of being happy with or feeling comfortable with a changing landscape, with a changing...
I don't know if it ultimately gives, you know, if that equals success. I mean, I think that... I am a certain personality that can manage that. I'm not suggesting that everybody is the same, but I think that we have, you know, our young people and not just young people, but old people like me, we have to be adaptable and flexible, and we have to, you know, if you look at the construction industry and the rate of pace of change there, you know, I was involved in a piece of work that suggested in 2025 the 30,000 roofers that we have at the moment will be down to 330 or something because, you know,
automation and changing.
So so we all have to
It's not just architecture, you know, is it?
We all have to upskill, down, you know, side skill, or you know, we all have to start to not stick our heads in the sand, but we have to say, okay, what's coming and how can we contribute to it and how can we be a part of it? And if we choose to be a part of it, then what an amazing, exciting, incredible journey that might be, you know. And who wants to be left behind? I don't.
No. So back to Stirling again.
Third nomination. Yes.
I've got 2010, was it, when was that the first?
Clapham Manor, Clapham Manor School, and I'm so embarrassed that I can't, yeah, of course, 2010, and then last year with Trafalgar Place.
Okay.
And, so this was our third nomination.
Okay.
And I think actually for me, the, I really felt that it deserved to win.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, and the ones that deserve to win don't always win. So it was, you know, it was absolutely, it was just over the moon.
Perhaps appropriate. I mean, you were sure it's commented on for its lack of building and its use of space and its problem solving, really.
Yeah.
I mean, so appropriate that that's given your, you know, kind of background.
You know, as a practice, as an architecture practice, what do you want to do? Build iconic buildings. So, you know, I say this, I hope, in the spirit that it needs to be taken. And that is, I think it was very, you know, it was a generosity of spirit as well that led us to step back and say, no, it's actually, this, you know, creating great places and spaces is what we do, and we do it for people and place. We don't do it for our own architectural kind of gratification, in which case it's absolutely right that we hold ourselves back and we don't do actually what was wanted.
Yeah.
You know, we actually talked the, you know, the,
talk
the
them
peer
out
of, you know, out of designing an iconic building, which is, you know, it's no, it's
no mean feat.
Yeah,
when a client comes in with an idea.
Exactly, you know, I mean, and that's, but, you know, what goes around comes around, and look, you know, look what's happened.
Yeah.
So I think all of those things are very meaningful to us and make this a really meaningful win.
you talked about then, the I'm just wondering about the future of the practice then. You've taken on another director,
yes,
you say.
Yeah.
And who's that?
That's Jonas Lenzer. So okay. He's been with us since he was, as most, I think, people have in the practice.
Yeah.
He came as an intern and could hardly speak English. He came over from Germany. So he represents what is a very international practice.
Yeah.
And, I mean, like everyone here, he's got such a kind of drive and enthusiasm and passion that, you know, we felt that it was right to think about how we might hand over eventually, you know, in time, a practice that is not really about me, Philip and Alex. It's about the people that, you know, kind of work and are very much part of DRMM. You know, if you've ever been through the office, you know, we have people all over the world we call DRMMers, you know, and they, you know, the eight people around the table at the Sterling Prize dinner in London don't work for us anymore. They're all ex-DRMMers.
Right.
But because they were part of the process and part of our family, extended family, we felt that we should, you know, it was right that they were there.
And is that then you're thinking about, I mean, kind of other projects coming through now? Is that what's next, I guess, for big, building at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, who knows what the Sterling Prize will bring? I mean, it's not the first prize we won.
No.
And you know, we always think, oh, great, you know, it's just lie back and wait for the work to come in.
Take a number, there's a queue outside.
Exactly, but of course it never happens like that. No. So I just, you know, we've always grown very organically.
Yeah.
You know, we're not kind of big boom and busters, and that's how we like to do it. So we take on work that we feel we can add something to and that's we want, you know, we want to do, and we're lucky enough to be able to choose what that is.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't think that will change.
Okay.
And I, we all have different types of ambition in terms of the sorts of things that we want to work on. And we, you know, we try to make sure that we have a good mix of projects in the office in terms of scale, in terms of diversity. And, you know, I think we just continue to do that really.
And then outside of the practice, any other challenge? You're not scaling any other mountains coming up? There's no other...
as you probably know, I was successfully treated for breast cancer last year. And I think, to be brutally honest, this last year has been about me filling up as much of my time as possible so that I don't think about, you know, what could be. And so I had a completely incredible summer of learning to scuba dive, going to Burning Man, you know, cycling from Porto to Lisbon, culminating in my climb of Kilimanjaro, and actually raising £20,000 in the
which is amazing,
alongside my friend Bridget Rosewell, who we did it as a team.
Right.
And I got to the top. And I didn't find it physically challenging. I found it mentally challenging because I had 6 days to think, and I had nothing else I could fill my time and my brain
with. But trudging uphill,
And it did me a lot of good. And I, you know, I faced a lot of my demons, and I got to the top of it, the mountain. And I thought, okay, I'm done now. I don't need to keep proving I'm alive, and I really could give myself a break and get back to work.
Yeah, bit of time in beaches. And,
So I came back with a kind of renewed sense of focus.
Summits
lots
of summits climbed.
So I've got a few to climb here, so save my energy. Yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
And
huge
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much.
On Sterling.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Sadie Morgan. You can find out more about Sadie and her work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.